long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University, and I am joined by Ken Katkin, a professor of law at Chase Law School. Ken, welcome to The Politics Guys.
It is great to be back.
It's always fun to be doing the show with you. And, you know, this week we, of course, have all kinds of things going on as a result of the Israeli conflict in Gaza. But maybe a little bit more expanded than that, Ken. So Iran's consulate in the Syrian Damascus was destroyed at the beginning of this week on Monday. And although credit has not been taken yet, both Syria and Iran are calling it an Israeli airstrike. One of the men killed was Mohammad Reza Rahadi, who is a member of Iran's Revolutionary Guard. Now, Reuters confirmed the destruction of building, but not yet the cause. And even here at the end of the week, there has been, again, no credit taken for this strike. Syria released a statement that said, quote, F-25 planes fired 6 missiles at the Iranian consulate in Damascus, end quote. And Iran, in its own separate statement, said the response to the attack would be harsh, quote unquote, and directed at Israel. Iran has further reported that the killing was a meeting of leaders with Palestinian Islamic Jihad groups, but no outside groups have yet confirmed that. Outlets are speculating the reason for Zahadi's targeting is for his ammunition and weapons smuggling in Lebanon, which is one of the things that Iran is in fact involved in. The White House has so far this week declined to discuss anything other than it was aware of the reports of what was happening. Then, on Thursday, the CIA warned that Iran would be striking Israel within the next 48 hours. Right now, reports indicate Iran is potentially going to be using drones and missiles to fire at strategic locations inside of Israel. Further confirmation of this comes from Israel itself, which for the first time is openly noting that it is scrambling GPS signals over certain portions of the country, most prominently Tel Aviv. This has delayed civilian activities because most people are not used to using maps and used to using GPS in their phones, things like Google and Apple Maps. If Iran does strike Israel directly using drones, it would mark first in the conflict between those two countries, which has generally taken place through proxies. And this, of course, Ken, gets into some international law questions, especially what we might think of as targeting or assassination, which has been thrown around a lot this week, and something that I'm at least a little bit familiar with, if we want to get into that as well. But let's start there before we kind of get onto the American side of things. The tension here between Israel and Iran is high. We have what one side is calling an assassination and the other is just silent on. What's your take on this emergent expansion of the conflict?
Yeah, well, I guess first, although it's true, of course, that Israel's been silent on this, I don't think there's any doubt that this was an Israeli strike, right? They would deny it if it wasn't. And I think Israel isn't trying to really deny that they're the ones who did it. I think the sort of questions about whether this is going to cause escalations are, there are some international law questions there, but I think it's much more practical politics questions. In international law, you'd have the question of whether, who did they fire on? So, the Hezbollah, which is an Iran-backed militia, has been launching attacks into Israel. And if they were being armed and trained and coordinating on military strategy with the Iranian military, and the Iranian military was right there in Syria to plan military activities against Israel, then these would be legitimate military targets. Of course, on the other hand, Syria is not a combatant country. Even to the extent that Lebanon is, Lebanon isn't Syria, although Hezbollah is in both. And the building was, there's debate, I guess, about whether it was a civilian building or a military building. But I think Israel has said that this was purely a military building, just disguised as a civilian building. So there was no attack on civilian targets. So those are all kind of the legal questions. The real world practical strategic questions, I guess, would be, if there's going to be a response from Iran, what kind of response is it going to be? And I think Iran, almost certainly will have to respond. If you remember, though, like back in the Trump administration, Trump did a assassination of an Iranian general in Iran, and the Iranians did respond by, kind of in a token way, launching a bunch of missiles back at American bases. But they did it in such a token way that they made sure that nobody got killed. And I think that, that would be kind of the minimal kind of response that Iran might make. They're going to have to show some kind of response, but they're going to have to decide themselves whether they want to have a response that's mild enough that it won't draw further retaliation to that response, or whether they're willing to respond in a larger way and almost certainly escalate the exchange of hostilities.
Well, it seems on the political side, right? I agree with you. That's probably the more important place to start. Is that there does appear to be, and again, it's hard to triangulate precisely all, but I would say among those who have been more Palestinian sympathetic, that they think that Iran is going to have a larger, more meaningful response, and that this is the problem with allowing Israel to have the kind of military responses it had in Gaza, and this is just almost rogue state take. But I don't hear you saying that, despite that obviously you're not Palestinian, but you are, of course, more broadly left. So walk us through that as well, because that is an open conversation as well.
Yeah, I think, we talked about this last time we talked. I think that the U.S., at the same time that the U.S. has increasing qualms, and particularly the Biden administration has increasing qualms about the way Israel is conducting the war in Gaza. I think that's actually totally separate from the U.S. attitude towards Israeli security in the north, Israeli security against.
And again, to be clear, when you say the north, we're talking about the Lebanon border, and we're talking about these connections here. And this is primarily where Iran has been located most specifically.
Yeah, Iran has been backing Hezbollah, which is, as powerful as the government is in Lebanon, and Lebanon sits on the northern border of Israel. And Hezbollah is also powerful in Syria, which is just to the north of Lebanon and mostly doesn't have a border with Israel. And I think that U.S. security interests are extremely closely aligned with Israeli security interests at that front. The U.S. does not want a regional war breaking out between Israel and Lebanon or between Israel and Syria that's just going to spill over into being a conflagration in the whole Middle East, really. And so I think that's why it was so difficult for Biden to stop arms sales to Israel, right? Because Israel needs arms to in the north. And even to the extent that Biden thought that Israel was abusing the arms and using them against civilians more than they should in Gaza, it was never a feasible remedy to say, okay, we're not going to sell you any more arms, because the U.S. was never willing to compromise Israel's security in the north, because doing so would almost certainly lead to a wider regional conflagration. Like if Hezbollah could succeed in an attack on northern Israel, if they had any chance of doing that, they would do it. And if they did, then you'd have a conflagration that would kind of burn up the whole Middle East, and that's really, really contrary to U.S. security interests. So all that's a long way of getting around to saying I think that Israel did do this, but I don't think they did it without checking in with the USA. I don't think it's a rogue state thing. I think there's much more security coordination between the U.S. and Israel in the north, even though I do believe that Biden is very vexed with the way Netanyahu is conducting the war in Gaza, and Netanyahu's not listening to the things that Biden's saying in Gaza. But I wouldn't extrapolate and think that that's how it is in the north. I think there's still pretty strong security coordination in the north.
Well, let's add that element in because, of course, I had been separating those. Meanwhile, this week, you know, the Biden administration has taken its strongest note or tone yet against Israel, right? So Thursday, President Biden told Prime Minister Netanyahu that in the wake of a strike that killed 7 World Central Kitchen aid workers, that it's time for the humanitarian situation, that the humanitarian situation in Gaza is, quote unquote, unacceptable. Biden made clear the need for specific, concrete, and measurable steps to address civilian harm in a call with Netanyahu, and for the first time implied, and this is what you were getting at in your answer there, Ken, that U.S. military aid is going to be future dependent on addressing those humanitarian concerns. And this was, I think, the strongest of the language, and so maybe the most striking, to have a ceasefire. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby told reporters that there needed to be a dramatic increase in humanitarian assistance within the coming hours and days. He then went on to argue that the time for a ceasefire has come for a ceasefire in exchange for items from Hamas. That, however, as we've talked about, that idea that there's going to be potentially prisoners on the table is not even on the table for Hamas. So I kind of focused in on those comments from Kirby because we have already talked on the show about Hamas has said that's not a possibility because Hamas claims to not have knowledge of the condition or location of the remaining prisoners. And so this seems more like really a call for a ceasefire in order to shore up the loss of support Biden is suffering on the left to kind of bring it in. And I know last week, or not last week, the last time we were on the show, we were trying to kind of get at where that was standing on the left. And I've looked at this again. And matter of fact, this week, Gallup had yet another new poll that revealed that only 36% of people across the board, regardless of ideological support, supported Israel. But that kind of beguiles a pretty big ideological difference. If you do it ideologically, only 18% of Democrats support Israel as it relates to Gaza, and Republican support, while it's dropped, is not as strong. It's still there. Then, at the same time, though, you know, the more closely, and this I thought was a unique little bit of data. If you break it up by who's following the news, so those individuals who have followed the conflicts and followed the news, the more you pay attention to the news, the more you're likely to support Israel. I don't know exactly what to make of that, but there you go. And this comes in the wake of we have individuals walking out on Biden this past week in protest of Hamas. The Nation here on Friday argued that the continuing protest against Biden, which is now by their calculations over 500,000 voters, most recently in Wisconsin, is pushing him to end aid, military aid in its totality to Israel. Or in the words of Representative Mark Pecan, who is a Democrat, it's a big effing deal, is what he said yesterday. And so then on the other side, of course, Ken, we have MSNBC reporting that Israeli-American family of Goldberg Pollan is shocked by these comments from Biden, saying, look, you're not pushing Hamas, you're pushing Israel, and they're still holding people. So let's add in this, you know, there's an American domestic element to this as well, Ken. So I hear what you're saying in your response that, you know, the Lebanon border is different, but it doesn't appear that that is what's being asked for, at least domestically on our side. So what do you make of that and the tightrope that Biden is having to walk?
Yeah, it is a tightrope that he's having to walk. We started to talk about this again last time we talked, and we were talking about how that both Biden and Netanyahu have domestic political reasons in their own countries why they need to actually have a very serious public rift with each other.
Right.
Biden needs to, you know, really have a rift with Netanyahu and not be seen, you know, as a partner with Netanyahu in the Gaza enterprise. It's absolutely essential for Biden's domestic political purposes that he do that. And it's similarly essential for Netanyahu's political purposes that he not seem to be pushed around by Biden. So I think they both have a strong interest in actually having a rift with each other. And we're seeing that. But I think in terms of what it really means on the ground, it may mean less than it looks like, because Biden, you know, for all the reasons that I was just talking about with the North, he is committed to protecting Israel's national security, and that aligns with U.S. interests. Any president should be interested in preventing like a full-scale hot war between Israel and its neighboring countries from breaking out. And I think that is the U.S., the main U.S. security interest there. And Biden's not really backing away from that. So, you know, the way that his demands for a ceasefire have been phrased, and the way that his threats that we will stop supplying arms if there's not a ceasefire have been phrased, it is linked to the release of the hostages. And everybody knows there won't be a release of the hostages.
Right. As we were just talking, maybe Hamas is already once again said, nope, can't happen.
Yeah, and it wouldn't be in their interest. And so, you know, they actually, you know, it's one thing that I think is very hard for a lot of Americans to see is you look at the situation where, you know, Hamas killed about 2,000 Israelis, and then in Gaza there's been about 30,000 Palestinians killed. And most people looking at that would say, wow, you know, the Palestinians. Yeah, it's disproportionate, and the Palestinians have suffered a lot more than the Israelis have. And in fact, that 30,000 is against a population of less than 2 million, you know, whereas the 2,000 is against a population of 10 million. So that exacerbates it even more. But I just don't think that's how Hamas looks at it. You know, I think they look at that and think they've won. They're winning. You know, that the mere 30,000 Palestinian lives they had to pay to drag Israel into a situation where world opinion is being turned against it is just so well worth it. They'd be happy to pay twice that many lives. And if twice as many people got killed in Gaza now, you know, Hamas would think that's even more of a victory. So when you have dynamics like that, where, you know, Hamas really doesn't have an interest from their perspective in actually getting a ceasefire. What they have an interest in is turning world opinion against Israel. Then I think they're not gonna release these hostages. I don't know how much I believe about whether they could or couldn't, or even about whether these hostages are still alive or not. Although I think Israeli intelligence does think at least some of them are still alive, but. I just think that that's the thing, that Biden has that kind of backdoor out of carrying through on these threats, because all of his threats against Netanyahu are linked to the idea, you know, that, you know, if the hostages are released, there has to be a ceasefire. If the hostages are released and there's not a ceasefire, we're going to stop selling arms to Israel. We're going to really change our diplomatic relations with Israel, et cetera. But you know, that's all contingent on something that really isn't going to happen, which is the hostages getting released.
How long do you think he can remain there? And this is something that I've been thinking about this week. Again, when you drill into those numbers a little bit more deeply, right? Again, so just on the face of it, only 18% of Democrats in the support of the conflict, and the number barely changes. So, you know, you talk about having the back door out, which is the hostages, but whether you include the hostages in that equation or not, the number really does not bump up. And so my question to you is if he uses that back door, does that really help him any in terms of his own domestic situation?
I think it does, but only in one particular way. It's indirect, right? I think it doesn't change the polls on a day-to-day basis at all, which I think is your point. But I think it does change his relations with other elected Democrats, right? So, one thing he needs to really do is reunify the party, right? And there is some fraying of party unification right now, and there's some elected Democrats who've been very critical of President Biden's handling of the Gaza situation.
And yes, very.
I think to the extent that he makes changes in his rhetoric and you know, perhaps small, but still changes in his actual policy, but more changes in his rhetoric and, you know, much more using his bully pulpit to criticize Netanyahu, to demand better treatment for the Gazan people. And there's some practical things that happen, right? They did just
bully
Netanyahu into opening up all the borders so more aid could come in and things like that. And they
So this morning, they reopened the Erez crossing, which is that northern Gaza point, the primary entry point. You also have the opening of the Ashdod support, which again is also just north of Gaza, for increased aid. And now, of course, the White House has said just before we went on the show here on Friday that those are welcome, but, quote, must now be fully and rapidly implemented, end quote.
Yeah. So see, that's what I'm talking about, that you're seeing both, you know, he is influencing certain kinds of positive changes, and his rhetoric is continuing to keep pressure on and say that's not enough. There has to be even more positive changes. And what I'm saying, the political benefit of that is that it'll bring around, you know, all the elected Democrats, including the ones that have been critical of him, because he is responding to their concerns. And I think even though, you know, you're pointing out the general public, you know, doesn't give them any credit at all, really, for, you know, something that happened this week. If they don't,
I mean, we couldn't even measure it yet anyway.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm open to your idea that they don't. But I think what they do is they do listen. You know, there's influencers, you know, so if the members of the squad in the House of Representatives, you know, start actually lauding the way he's changed gears in response to their critique and done more of what they wanted him to do all along, you know, even though he didn't do it initially, I think that will yield political dividends for him.
I've got another kind of question, and it's something that we've also discussed in our Discord group. And just as a reminder to listeners, supporters, depending on your level of support, have access to us as the Politics Guys on Discord. And, you know, my positions on this particular issue have not been the most popular on our Discord always. And that's something that we've had some position on. But, you know, this week, as soon as the thing in Syria came out, this kind of went along with this narrative, and I'm curious about your take on this, Ken. You know, immediately the term assassination starts getting thrown around this past week. I mean, almost instantaneously. Oh, Israel is assassinating people. Israel, and we continue to hear, and Israel. So Israel is assassinating people, and they're committing genocide. How can we be involved? And it seems unlikely that those words and those terms, and we covered the issue of genocide more properly, or, you know, a number of weeks ago now, months ago now, when this first came up on the show, yourself and myself. But it seems clear to me, although I don't have particular data, that quickly we are willing to assign Israel the kinds of negative international terms that we don't generally quickly throw around with other democratic countries. And I wonder why that is. And I don't want to always immediately go to anti-Semitism, but it feels like you just can't help but have to throw that into the mix here a little bit. Or maybe I'm missing something. And I've been really careful to try to think about this because, you know, again, many of our listeners have said, Trey, you just don't understand. You know, people are dying in Palestine at a disproportionate rate, the way that you'd set up. You know, how can you continue to be kind of mixed on that? You're more or less just in favor of killing women and children. And I've been trying to think through that. And so I'm going to ask you that question as well, Ken.
Yeah, well, you did use the word other democracies. And I think that may partly explain it, right? Because there certainly, like a lot of the Middle Eastern Arab countries have had, you know, wars against each other or civil wars in recent years, where the death tolls have been a lot higher, where the civilian death tolls have been a lot higher, where the atrocities have been higher. And I would certainly agree with you. You don't hear as much outrage about that in the United States.
You don't even hear any international court cases being brought saying, well, look, this is genocide. We've got to stop that.
Right, right. I agree. But of course, those countries are not democracies either. Right. And maybe, you know, maybe, you know, if there's a explanation other than anti-Semitism, it's that, you know, Israel's conduct, you know, while probably fairly mild for its region of the world, if you really compare them to other countries in that region of the world, is it's not commonly seen in contemporary democracies. Now, certainly the U.S., you know, you could look at like the U.S. involvement in Vietnam 50 years ago, and there were many atrocities against civilian populations there. I think there was less of that in our involvements in Afghanistan or in Iraq, but there were some. some like at Abu Ghraib and things like that in Iraq. And so, you know, I think the fact that it's a democracy may mean that people hold it to a higher standard. The fact that it feels like a Western country, even though it's in the Middle East, you know, and the other countries in the Middle East don't feel like Western countries, you know, may mean that people hold it to an implicitly higher standards as well, or explicitly. But I'm not going to rule out your hypothesis about anti-Semitism either. I just think there could be other explanations, but that could be the explanation.
Yeah, again, I wasn't trying to force you into one. I was just, again, when I'm always careful when enough people say, look, Trey, you got to be careful of your bias. You've got to be aware of that. Maybe I'm blinding myself, right? And you have to think about it and ask other people you respect, hey, Ken. Those kinds of questions.
Yeah. I mean, it's really, you know, when you're talking about popular opinion, you're talking about a lot of different people's opinions. So it's hard to get to definite answers about why they think what they think, I guess.
Is there anything else that we've missed on this that you'd like to talk about here?
No, I think we covered it. I mean, it's such a fast-breaking story, and I'm sure we'll be talking about it again. But I guess the big thing I already said, but I'll just kind of hammer it once more, is I think we are seeing, you know, increasingly a rift between Biden and Netanyahu that both of those leaders actually need politically for domestic political reasons. And I would expect it to just keep getting wider and wider and wider, and to hear Biden's critiques of Netanyahu really escalate more and more.
Yeah, and I agree with the fact that they're going to both be there. I think the thing that we're going to be looking at next, Ken, because it always appears, I think the most international news happens when we come on. It's just a pattern of unobserved nature, like light particles. But I do think that Netanyahu is facing an increasingly difficult front in his own country, and that would certainly potentially at least give a partial reprieve to Biden in his own reelection bid. But we should put those on hold, because it's just still too early, I think, to really try to analyze how that might impact. Again, I know it feels like elections are around the corner, but it's the beginning of April.
Oh, here. Yeah. And in Israel, you know, they could call for elections whenever in Israel. And Gantz, who's, you know, Netanyahu's rival but partner in the war coalition government, Gantz has been calling for early elections now. But I think as long as Netanyahu can hold his coalition together, he doesn't have to call them till fall of 26.
Yeah. So he's got some time, more time, in fact, than Biden, as you rightfully know. Well, Ken, why don't we turn our attention back to the United States? And specifically to the southern United States, or so far south that you're not even south anymore. That's called Florida. And, you know, as a former Floridian, I can tell you that is very true. Florida is both southern and not in so many ways. But this week, that has nothing to do with what we're talking about. Instead, the Florida Supreme Court ruled to uphold a 15-week ban on abortion in the state. Now, many of you might say, but listen, I was looking at the headlines. Well, that means as well that a newer ban on 6 weeks will be able to stand under the same reasoning. So even though the court was actually ruling on the 15-week ban, that allowed for there to be other kinds of bans, which means the 6-week ban, the newer ban, is also going to go into effect. So we had both of those, but effectively now a 6-week ban is going to stand. It also, that is the Supreme Court of Florida, allowed a constitutional amendment to move forward that would enshrine abortion protections in the state to appear on the November ballot. So what's going on? What was the keys here? So for those of you who have not been a Floridian, the Floridian Constitution provides, quote, the right to be let alone and from government intrusion into, and I'm skipping a few things, private life, end quote. And for those of you who want to follow along at home, that's Article 1, Section 23 of the Florida Constitution. So unlike the United States Constitution, there is a more direct privacy clause in the Florida Constitution. And so the question in the case is if restricting abortion actually interferes with that portion of the Constitution. And the court did some unique things in their ruling. They explicitly first, quote, recede from our prior decisions, end quote. So in earlier decisions, they had followed the Supreme Court model, but they argue here that they need to pull back from that to be consistent with Dobbs and not allow the district court's injunction on the abortion ban to move forward. They argue that the earlier cases had not relied on the meaning of the words as understood by the ratifiers, but we're rather looking at it through the lens of the U.S. Supreme Court. But because in Dobbs we overturned Roe v. Wade, that doesn't make any sense. So we have to look at the plain meaning of the words in Article 1, Section 23. And as a result, the ban can move forward. Now, this is a big deal because it takes things directly to the ballot box, Ken. So Republicans are arguing that the ballot measure that the Supreme Court has pushed forward is really too inclusive of abortion and therefore isn't going to hurt them in November. The measure itself would allow abortion until viability. It doesn't define that, but it's generally understood to be about weeks. And then after it, if a primary health physician determines the patient, healthcare provider argues it's necessary. And so Rick Scott has effectively called this late-term abortion. Now, meanwhile, Democrats hope that this might shift Florida a little bit more purple, maybe a little more blue, especially for knocking off Senator Rick Scott. And empirically, abortion as a ballot measure so far has been very successful, even in red states such as Kentucky, Kansas, and Ohio. And this tracks with post-Dobbs polling. 62% of individuals, according to the University of North Florida Research Lab poll, said they would support an amendment or a law allowing abortion up to viability. So, Ken, what do you make of what's happening in Florida?
Well, I have to bring a little bit of a legal perspective onto this, even though this was mostly policy questions that you were talking about and political questions. One thing that I think has not been clear from most of the reporting on this ballot initiative that's going on the ballot in Florida is that it cannot succeed in restoring abortion rights in Florida, because Florida is the only state in the country where, you remember over the last couple of years after the Dobbs decision, there in many states that allow ballot initiative and referendum, basically pro-life groups put on ballot initiatives and referendums to try to raise the percentage of votes that would be needed to amend a state constitution.
And we actually talked about that in a couple of instances ourselves.
Yes. And Florida is the only state where that succeeded. So you know, we blocked that here in Ohio, where I am. And then we did get a pro-choice a constitutional amendment after that. But in Florida, they succeeded in passing that amendment. So in Florida, it would now take a 60% popular vote to restore abortion rights. And I think by every poll I've ever seen, that isn't going to happen. And so it's extremely likely that, as here in Ohio, you know, another basically red state like Florida, that the majority is pro-choice, but the support for pro-choice caps out around 56-57%. It's not going to be. So I think that the almost certain outcome of the Florida ballot initiative is that somewhere between 55-60% of the voters.
That's an excellent point, Ken. Yeah. That's one of the reasons I was bringing up North Florida's Research Lab poll, because it was, you know, it's a really good one. And it did show us, again, over 60% in
Florida. Over 60.
It was 62%.
Yeah.
That's why I put it there, I think, as a potential positive sign for Democrats. Now, that's probably still not enough to meet the 60, but that's at least what I would call competitive.
Yeah. And what I will say about that, and this is where I get to the political part of it, it is competitive, but I don't think it's going to carry. But I think what it will do, and this is where you said positive sign for Democrats, if a lot of Democrats turn out because they want to vote for that initiative, and not only Democrats, because most independents want to vote for that initiative, and even, you know, some Republicans want to vote for that initiative and maybe want to make sure that it has a chance of being implemented. I think that the bigger impact of the ballot initiative in Florida is not going to be on restoring abortion rights, which I think is a really uphill battle there under their voting rules, but it's actually going to be on turnout for the election, and its impact will definitely favor Democrats. Now, I don't know that that's going to be enough in Florida. I mean, one story we've seen in Florida is that it used to be a very purple state, and it's kind of like Ohio. you know, moved from purple to red, and it's been extremely difficult for Democrats to win there. But what I think is going to happen in this election, I'm not going to predict that Democrats will win, but I'm going to say these kinds of conditions give the Democrats the best possible chance to win in Florida that they're going to have. And so if they don't win, I think we can really say Florida's gone totally red. But I think if there's still some question about whether Florida is winnable for Democrats, this abortion issue, you know, puts the wind at their back that they would need if they're still close enough that they could sometimes win.
Yeah, the only thing I would add to this is, and this is my, you know, media politics side, my nerdy side coming out here, because this is my area. I think the one thing that makes Florida a little bit unique is the different possible framings. And you know, one of the things, again, if you follow along the show, you've probably heard us talk about this before, but media effects and voting and campaign effects, they're not generally so much in terms of persuasion, but there's these other kinds of communication and effects. And so I'm using this one framing. It's a particular one. Since you take an issue and the way that you view it changes the amount of support that you're going to have for it. And so, again, I'm going to turn to that most recent poll from North Florida Research Lab. And the numbers will shift depending on, so for example, you're absolutely right, Ken, about, you know, generally speaking in the country, a little more than half of the country wants some kind of abortion rights. But depending on how you frame it, those polling numbers change relatively dramatically. And I think because the Florida amendment is more vague than its cousins in Kentucky, Kansas, and Ohio, that this does offer an opportunity for Republicans to do it differently than in those three. Although I agree with you, this would be a departure from that norm. But I really think it depends on the framing of this. Does it end up by most people looking like a more generic abortion, health of the mom, you know, after you know what's going on, a viability for abortion? Or does it look more like a way to have abortion all the way up? Late term abortion is not very popular, comparatively speaking. And it's, I don't know how to get at that. I don't know how to measure that. But I would add that here as something that I do think makes the Florida case a little bit unique. But I agree with your assessment in general, though, that these kinds of direct democracy moments are not going to help any Republican in either national or state elections win, because in the era of, you know, winning the Supreme Court to make this local, which they did in Dobbs, has been hugely helpful to Democrats overall.
Yeah, the one thing I might have a slight point of disagreement with one thing you just said. I don't think it matters what the language of these ballot initiatives say, because no matter what the language of the ballot initiatives say, the pro-life people are going to say, you know, the argument that you just said. They're going to say, this is going to protect late-term abortion, you know, don't pass this. And they're going to say that no matter how clear or how vague the language is, no matter how untenable of a statement that is, you know, that's the argument that's going to be out there. And I think that's completely independent of what the text of the amendment actually says. And I think almost all voters are getting their information from who they listen to rather than from really trying to parse the text of the amendment themselves.
Well, no, so just to be clear, I'm not arguing that it's not just the text that creates framing. I think that's one of the things that's difficult. It's whatever you're looking at. It's the reality moment in combination with the way that it framed by those individuals that surround you. Now, we could spend a whole show on, you know, trying to get into that.
Also, but I thought you were saying that the text of the Florida amendment was more vague than the text of the, say, the Ohio amendment about what it protected. And I don't know whether that's true or not, but I really would resist the idea that that will influence anybody's vote.
Well, the part that is making a little bit different is that if you take a look at the five parts of, say, the Ohio, you know, what was titled the Right to Reproductive and Protections for Health and Safety Act, it does not have a post-viability guarantee in the way that the Florida proposed amendment does. And so those kinds of pieces do, I think, allow different kinds of frames to have more or less traction.
I think they would if partisans would tell the truth, but I don't think we're in that universe. You know, I heard plenty of the pro-life people in Ohio saying that this would protect post-viability abortions, even though it wouldn't. And I think, you know, people who got their information from that side, that's what they heard. So that's why I'm saying I don't think for you to even talk about the difference between what's protected by the Florida one versus what's protected by the Ohio one, you have to imagine that the voters are actually reading the Constitution to get to get or the amendments to get those differences. Because if they're just listening to what people are telling them, it says there's going to be, you know, so much. Just people are going to tell voters what they think the voters want to hear. And it's going to be independent of what's actually in the text of the amendments, I think.
Anything left that we need to take on here, the Florida Supreme Court?
You know, there's just one thing I didn't mention,
please,
but I would.
Please.
So there was an amendment about 5-6 years ago in Florida that did pass. In fact, it passed under the rule when only 50% used to be required, but it still got more than 60%. And this was an amendment that re-enfranchised felons. So this was
I was there for that one. Yes,
there for that. You
yep.
voted in that. So I take it you were one of the 65% in Florida who may have voted for that.
I was in favor of that. Yes.
Yes. As were 2/3 of your countrymen. Well, you know, it never was implemented. And I think that's the other thing about this, that even if the pro-choice side actually does get above that 60% threshold, which I think is very unlikely, because the entire Florida government, both houses of the legislature, the governor, the courts, every part of the Florida government is in the hands of Republicans now. If they just decide not to implement it, there's really no recourse, because usually we rely on separation of powers to hold government accountable to law. But if all branches of government are going to ignore a law, there's really no recourse if it's a state law. And we do have an example with that felon reenfranchisement, which literally never happened. And I don't know, you know, so I think that's another thing to think about in terms of this one.
You know, I hadn't thought about that. That's a fair point. I'll have to ponder that more. And because obviously, as we continue to move towards November, I think the goal of having these kinds of ballot initiatives in either purple-ish to non-purple Texas, I mean, one of the things we're not going to talk about this week, but of course, it was kind of a minor item, is even in Texas, Ted Cruz feeling a little bit of a pinch own state in terms of fundraising and other items. But this as a narrative thread is certainly not going away, and we'll have to continue to look at it. And I'm, for one, am curious to see the extent to which, well, especially as it relates to what Trump is back on the ballot, given that we do know, because Trump supporters, and this is just an empirical thing, you know, Democrats have moved from having a lot of poor voters, those kinds of what you might consider more likely to not turn out voters, have switched, and they have become in large part Trump voters. We talked about this on the show with some researchers on their book on Union Blues a number of months ago. And so, you know, Trump being on the ballot does in fact have a pretty big shift, and we haven't yet seen what the Trump plus these kinds of abortion ballot initiatives will do at the same time. And so just empirically, I am curious about how that will pan out.
Yeah.
Okay. So why don't we move forward, Ken? And I mean, I'm already bringing up Trump. So let's move into Trump. So Trump media and technology stock fell again today sharply. Shares are down as of doing of this show, just under 10% after closing down 5.5% on Thursday. And this has all led to a lot of dispute as to why. Now, the Trump media's revenue, well, it came, we discovered this week, to $4.1 million for 2023, and it posted a net loss of $58.2 million, although it did receive a $30 million cash infusion as part of its merger. And in terms for Trump, this has set the value of the public company immensely, but of course, he couldn't cash in on it immediately. And so many analysts, and I don't disagree, I'm curious what your take on this is, really see these kinds of retail investors as moving in to Trump media and technology as more of a bet on who might win in November rather than on the underlying value of the company itself. And as a matter of fact, this is taking up Trump's attention as well. Trump posted on Truth Social on Thursday, quote, "I think Truth is amazing," in his all caps. First of all, it is very solid. Having $200 million in cash and zero debt. Again, I'm trying to emphasize the all caps word. More importantly, it is the primary way I get the word out, end quote. And he goes in to talk about this. And Ken, I think this story fell a little bit under the radar. But of course, for me, I couldn't help but want to focus on it a little bit because, I mean, Trump is in New York right now, having to put up a bail for the mismanagement valuation of his own companies.
Right.
And here we are talking about a company. I just didn't stop. I mean, unless you follow kind of trading news, I didn't think this really got the kind of attention it deserved. So what are your thoughts on this, especially given what we know his legal standing is so far with his other overvaluations?
Yeah, well, I mean, he can't totally control the valuations of a publicly traded stock. That there are transactions in the market that determine its valuation. So I think it's a little different than, it's not as simple as him lying about the size of his apartment and then multiplying some price by phony number of square feet. People are actually trading this stock, so right. It has a value that's more ascertainable. But I think a couple thoughts I would have about this. One is, you know, on his side, I'll say, It is generally the case in internet stocks that, you know, their future upside of these businesses can be really bear no relation to their present operating results. So, you know, companies like Facebook and Amazon lost money for their first couple decades in business.
Yeah, and Amazon especially.
Amazon especially. But they were always valued high. Because the market sort of, I think, always correctly looked at this and said, well, the key thing here is that Amazon is establishing market share. And if they have money losing operations that they can afford, and then eventually what that means is they have millions or billions of customers. And then they finally, once they've established that market share, you know, turn their attention to, you know, pricing so they can make money, then, you know, in the end, they're going to, you know, the sky's going to be the limit about how much money they can make. And so I'm just pointing that out on Trump's side here to say it's not automatically true that just because it's a company that doesn't have much revenue and that loses money hand over fist, that means that there's no good reason to invest in it from a financial standpoint. It is in a line of business where that actually would be a fairly typical story, that companies that don't make much revenue and that are losing money hand over fist could be, in fact, the companies with the greatest future upside potential. So I will point that out before I say the whole thing's a fraud. But I do think in his case there's really a lot of reason to doubt that he's the next Amazon or he's the next Facebook or something like that, because he's entering, you know, unlike Amazon, which started selling stuff online really before it had any significant competitors and was actually always the biggest player in that space and was just getting bigger and bigger and bigger during the years it was losing money, which does seem to be a good way to position yourself to eventually make a lot of money. You know, Truth Social is entering a space where it's very, very saturated. You know, a lot of people are already on Facebook or Instagram or Threads or
TikTok,
X. You know, all this stuff's already out there. And he's kind of, you know, targeting a market segment that's relatively smaller, you know, than what his competitors are targeting, right? So, you know, Facebook and, you know, TikTok and you know, even Twitter for a long time, you know, we're you know, basically trying to get everybody on there, whereas, you know, Truth Social is only really appealing to conservatives. So it's a much smaller potential market share, and it's in a saturated space. So I don't see a lot of reason to think they're ever going to do very well. But that's, you know, that's my opinion, and different people could have different crystal balls when they're looking at the future. Another thing about its financials that I just read in the New York Times the other day, and it's fascinating to me because I didn't really get any of this, is it's not very visible. But the company, about 60% of all the shares are owned by Trump, and that's why he's worth so much, because he has so many shares, and the shares were worth, you know, about $50. I think they've been going down a little bit, but he has 60% of all the shares. That's millions of shares. And apparently only about 5 million shares of this company are being publicly traded, and that's out of 137 million shares, right? So there's 137 million shares in the company. Trump owns 60% of them. Other insiders own a lot of the rest, and only 5 out of 137 of those millions of shares are in the market. And also, almost all the people who bought shares in the open market, almost all of them, 4.9 million out of 5 million shares that are in the market, are already on loan to short sellers. So, you know, short sellers are people who borrow shares of stock from someone else who owns them in order to bet, you know, that the price will go down, right? So every, all you know, 4.9 out of 5 million of the shares that have actually been sold publicly, what the buyers did was they loaned them to short sellers who want to bet that the price is going to keep going down. And in fact, that's caused a huge premium on the fee that they can get for the loan. So this is almost an incredible number, and I want to go slowly through this. But if the current stock price is $50, you know, for most stocks, if they were trading at $50 a share, and you wanted to short sell that stock, you could pay someone maybe $1 to borrow it from them. And then, you know, if it went down to $49, you'd break even. If it went down to $48, you'd make money. But with the Trump media stock, it's actually the rate to borrow it is $20 a share, which means a short seller, you know, would have to see that stock go down from $50 below $30 before they could make money. And yet, even with that, substantially all the shares that have been sold have been short sold. So it really adds up to, you know, an enormous lack of confidence in this company's future out there in the actual markets.
I had seen that too, but I love that you went through it better than I could have. So.
Yes, no. Really. I mean, if that's what every share that's been sold, and it's only 5 million out of 137 million, but out of the shares that have been sold to the general public, substantially all of those shares, people are willing to bet $20 against 50 that the stock will go down by more than 20, which is what it would have to do for them to make money.
Yeah, and you're right. It's hard to overestimate how unusual it is to have that cost to do those kinds of shorts. From a guy who does, in fact, follow the stock market pretty closely. Well, Ken, I think we're going to need to end it right there and say, listen, if you're not already a supporter of the Politics Guys, I hope you'll consider becoming one, because without you, this podcast just doesn't happen. But you also get all other kinds of good stuff. Earlier, I was talking about our very active Discord group where, well, you know, we've been talking about things like Gaza, war, assassination, and the rest. And we'd love for you to be a part of that. And to do that, and to look at all the different things you get for the different levels of support, all you need to do is to head to patreon.com/politicsguys. So if you head to patreon.com/politicsguys, you can see the different levels of support you have there. You can pick the level of support that works for you, and you can become part of the Politics Guys team. And we would love for you to do that. Now, that's a great place to go, but I know many of you want other ways to support us, and you can. We're on Venmo, where we're at Politics Guys. You can also support the show through PayPal. All of those support links are in the show notes. Just go ahead and scroll now down in the app of your choice, or head to our website at politicsguys.com/support. But again, the best way is to head to patreon.com/politicsguys. If you'd like to get our midweek show, but you're just not in a position financially to do that, I say it every week. I understand. I don't make a lot of money. I've got 3 kids. I have a family, but we still want you to get those kinds of things. Please just reach out to us at mail@politicsguys.com, and one of us will get you set up. Now, whether you're a supporter or not, we would really appreciate it if you could subscribe, rate, or review us on the podcast app that you use. I know I say it all the time. I know you've probably done it, but do it again. It helps us a ton. And it also helps when you share those episodes on social media. And I want to let you know that I've got some fun things I'm going to be sharing on social media as we get into the summer. And so I hope you'll be a part of those shares as well. So look for that soon. I'm hoping to make it a whole lot more fun to share the Politics Guys with people who have not been a part of us. If you've got questions, gripes, or anything else you want to share with us, please send us a note at mail@politicsguys.com. We're also on Facebook and X. You can find all of those in our show notes. The executive producers of The Politics Guys are Bruce Johnson, Wilma Marino, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby. We'll be back with a new full episode next week, and I hope you'll join us then.
This podcast is part of the Deadly Group.